How are you doing? Okay. Enough time? Hour and a half? For lunch? Do you need more time in the future? Is it enough time to get to... Oh, okay. So, thanks for coming back on this hot day. So, we're talking about an introduction to the three principal aspects of path. Not a Tibetan invention, but something that's more well known in the Tibetan tradition of all the Buddha's teachings, bringing these out as a synthesis of the important elements to practice and to develop because of the fact that Tisha, who was Indian himself, and had gone to, so thanks for reminding me this morning, Sumatra, Jambi. Have any of you been to Jambi? You've been to Jambi? Have you visited the remains of the monastery there? Is it quite extensive? I mean, sort of must have been destroyed 1,000 years ago. Only what? What?
It's only left the base of the...
Only the base of things. It's kind of like, have you been to Nalanda also in India? Nalanda also, there's a couple of places where there's still some big things that have been renovated and some structures, but a lot of it is just down to the base. But Jambi was a place where Dharmakirti Serlingpa, he was called. Serlingpa, what is that? Suvarnadvipa, right, in Sanskrit. Ser is one of the correct spelling is, means gold in Tibetan. Ser, spelled a different way, means yellow, but Ser Ling means island or continent. So that's Suvarnadvipa. That was another name that I think I said this morning, Sumatrakirti, that's the name of Sanskrit name of Lama Tsongkhapa. So Suvarnadvipa was one of the names of the guru of Atisha, with whom he studied. And when he came back, having developed that bodhicitta, when he was invited to Tibet and spent the rest of his life there, he was able to pass on not only the lineage of bodhicitta, how to develop it in these various ways with great expertise, but it's said that the longevity of and the purity of the Tibetan tradition of Buddhism owed a large measure to the purity of Atisha's motivation. His motivation in going there and teaching and so forth was not for, you know, self, you know, raising his own stature to become famous or to receive offerings, or but for the benefit of sentient beings, out of compassion, out of this bodhicitta that's motivated by compassion that he developed. It's said that when Atisha would stand inside a house, looking outside in the fields, when he would see the cows, the disciples could hear him muttering, "Mother." You know, when you see, if you get to the point where you're so familiar with recognizing sentient beings as your mother, having been your mother in the past, if you see the cockroach and you wonder why that particular cockroach is in your kitchen, you can think, "Mother," rather than immediate revulsion. And instead of revulsion, feeling compassion that they have this form and right now and helpless and motivate you. So Atisha wrote in Tibet, amongst other things. He wrote other things, but he wrote this one text as kind of a ransom to the abbots in India that had allowed him to go there. They had said, "You had to come back after a certain number of years." I can't remember if it was 2 or 3 or whatever. He was not able to come back because there was a battle at the borders. So in compensation to these abbots, he wrote this text, which was a synthesis of all the Buddha's teachings. And being one of the great scholars and practitioners of Buddhism in India, when the abbots received it, it wasn't just like another text that they, you know, sort of put in the back burner. They actually looked at it and said, wow, this indeed, in short number of words, encompasses all the Buddha's teachings. And one of the features, two of the features of this book were, one, the mentioning of these three fundamentals of the path, pointing them out as very important: renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view of emptiness, the wisdom. Why don't I say emptiness? Why do I say the correct view of emptiness? Isn't emptiness something very precious and difficult to acquire? You going to say? Anyone? So my teacher, Lama Yeshe, said, emptiness is nothing special. Even excrement has emptiness as its nature. It's everywhere. What's rare and precious is the wisdom that realizes emptiness. Right? The right view, the correct view, which is usually refers to a conceptual understanding, and the correct direct realization of emptiness. That's what's rare and precious. That's what can propel us on the path. Realizing emptiness with the consciousness, the wisdom that realizes it, can give us the courage to develop bodhicitta, because we see that there's no self to cherish the way that our mind has grasped up till now. Our self is something very, very superficially designated to our body. But we could designate self, myself, to the entirety of sentient beings rather than just to this one body. So besides pointing out these three fundamentals, renunciation, bodhicitta, and the right view of emptiness, one of the special features of the Bodhipratibodhipam was the presentation of what he called the three levels of practitioners, the three kinds of persons. Do you know what I'm talking about? So what are those three? Yeah. A little bit louder. Singaporeans don't have loud voices. Americans, I think, would blurt out.
We pretend to be soft-spoken.
Again?
We pretend to be soft-spoken.
Oh, okay.
The persons of small capacity, middling capacity, and great capacity, the three scopes, is that
right? So the person of small capacity or initial engagement with the Dharma, in fact, the first level of practitioner that is legitimately is legitimate to refer to as a spiritual practitioner is a person of you could say initial scope, is someone who is aiming for the happiness of next life at least. So people today who call themselves Buddhists or Christians who are not necessarily motivated by the future, but mainly motivated about the present, or people that, whether they call themselves Christian, Buddhist, Muslim, whatever, if they're just motivated by the what seems to be the importance of this life alone, they don't constitute a religious practitioner, even if they make offerings. You know, they become big benefactors, they're renowned to be scholars or whatever, or even renowned to be religious people, because they might be philosophers of religion or propagators of a particular system. If their main purpose is the happiness of this lifetime, they're not a practitioner of initial scope. That was kind of like the first level. So oftentimes in America, West, we would say this is, even though we're east of Tibet here in Singapore, maybe we could consider to be Westerners in the sense of, you know, different than point of view of the Tibetans or of Buddhists that are there. our aims are often for the happiness of this lifetime. So we don't constitute initial practitioners. And for these kind of beings, as opposed to here, there's maybe a general belief in reincarnation. Is there anyone here who doesn't believe, who is not yet totally convinced in reincarnation? Maybe you have a generalist. Okay, so another Caucasian, right? You're Caucasian, right? Sir? You are Caucasian, right? I'm not mistaken. You're not actually a Singaporean, are you? What did he say? Norwegian? Not Singaporean, yeah. So anyway, that's it. Yeah. You have to, whoever holds the microphone has to turn it on first, make sure that it's working before you hand it to someone. Okay, now, not an important point. I wasn't trying to call you out. I just wanted to see. So someone who is from a different culture, generally, we're not so immediately part of our culture to believe in reincarnation, whereas most people here and in Tibet already had an abiding belief in reincarnation. So the idea of working for the future lives makes a lot of sense. But for some people who don't yet have the belief in future lives, to say that the demarcation of a religious person is to work for the benefit of future lives might seem a bit strange. What about Christians who are working to be born in heaven? From a Buddhist perspective, I think that would constitute a person of initial scope, definitely. And if you're emulating Christ, maybe almost bodhisattva-like, although if for a little child in Tibet to come, you know, come into the group of adults and they say, "What do you want to do when you grow up?" And say, "I want to become Buddha." Everyone would applaud that, would think that's very nice. But if a little child came in a group of Christians in America and they said, "What do you want to be?" And he said, "I want to become God." You know, they said, "Oh, you know, is it blasphemous? You can't, God is unapproachable, something different than us." You know, even to become Christ almost sounds like, you know, that would seem blasphemous because Christ is one particular person. But from a Buddhist perspective, that's a virtuous thought, to want to become Buddha. So the person of initial scope, the person of intermediate scope is a person that Atisha pointed out. This is now the real sense of a Buddhist practitioner, someone who wants to, not just aiming for the happiness of future lives, but is aiming to escape from cyclic existence. Even if I were to be born in the future as a human again, with better resources, better conditions, more intelligence, whatever, that life would finish. And I would have the possibility of falling into the lower realms, experiencing suffering. All of the pleasures I might experience being born as a god or all of these things are all of the nature of suffering. Yeah. Not one iota of real pleasure within cyclic existence. So that individual is the archetypal practitioner of the Theravada, let's say, the person who is wanting to achieve liberation. Liberation, moksha, another name for nirvana, the escape from cyclic existence. The third individual that Atisha pointed out was a person who saw that was also an inferior destination. And these three scopes of practice could be practiced simultaneously and should be practiced by anyone who aspires. Let's say the person of higher scope practices the meditations and practices of the individual of intermediate scope and practices the meditations and practices of the person of initial scope. The person of highest scope is one who is aiming to achieve enlightenment beyond liberation, beyond nirvana. The state of nirvana is one in which you have eliminated, ceased, brought about a true cessation of all of the afflictions, predominantly the life force of all of them, the grasping at true existence of phenomena and of persons. You've eliminated that from the root. All of the afflictions no longer function. One is like chilled out, right? And have, you know, bliss, but not the bliss of a bodhisattva or a Buddha. And because of that, at the time of one's lifespan has exhausted and one is about to die, one enters into one's mind stream continues on a meditative concentration on emptiness and remains in this state perhaps for eons. This is from the Mahayana point of view. From some Hinayana point of view, one is no longer exists. One just sort of is now sort of like one's name is canceled from the list of sentient beings. One no longer exists. You know, he was there, but now he's no longer there, like the snuffing out of a candle. Mahayana Buddhism and some of the Hinayana, like the Vaibhashika, say no, that's not the case, that the mind does continue. The Mahayana individual, the person who enters into the Mahayana from the beginning, or the person who achieves nirvana first and remains in that for eons, is later awakened by the Buddhas when their samadhi begins to diminish and is reminded that they have not achieved the highest goal. They have not achieved their own goal of total bliss, you know, the Dharmakaya, and they have not achieved the goal of sentient beings, the ability to emanate as the Nirmanakaya or Sambhogakaya. And not with reluctance, but with, you know, so looking back and thinking, wow, this individual now takes rebirth within cyclic existence again, not due to their contaminated karma under the influence like an ordinary person, but with choice, making use of some remnants of those karmic instincts in one's mind. They take rebirth in cyclic existence and work to practice the bodhisattva path, to develop bodhicitta, practice the bodhisattva path. It might take them a very long time, even though they've realized emptiness. You know, they have renunciation. They know emptiness directly, but they don't have that. They still have an obstacle to working for the benefit of sentient beings, which is called the self-cherishing attitude, right? The self-cherishing attitude. In Tibetans, do you know what the Tibetan name is, any of you? Rang Chenzin Gilo. Whereas the mind, which I'll repeat it again but in a minute, the mind of self-grasping is called Dak Zin. Dak means self. Zin means to grasp, or to hold, to apprehend. That's usually called dagzin. We say chuki dagzin, the grasping to a self of phenomena, or kangsaki dagzin, the grasping to a self of the person. Two kinds. Whereas there's a remnant left from that grasping to the self of persons that's called the self-cherishing attitude. Rang means another name for self, means oneself. Chezen means when something is very precious, to hold it as precious, like your Ming vase. No. Does anyone here have a Ming vase? Oh, precious. Maybe a better example today is your Cartier watch or your Mercedes car or your... What's that kind of handbag the ladies have that's... What would it? Everyone has so many names I'm hearing. There must be lots of different bags. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. The one that costs several thousand dollars. You press, if it gets a little spot on it, you're really worried. Something you hold is very dear. Che Zin, holding is dear. We say cherishing. This is the attitude that while we still have self-grasping, because of self-grasping, there's the apprehension of the self. And then because of the apprehension of the self, holding it as real, the attitude, natural attitude is, this is me, I've got to protect this. This is really important. If someone offends me, you know, this is something to be avoided, something to be retaliated against. If there is something that can enhance my happiness, then I should get that. All of these are motivated by the self-cherishing attitude. Rang Chenzen Gi Lo. Lo is a word. Is it a Sanskrit? Mati, I think. So, even once the self, even say the arhats, even though they've eliminated the self-grasping, they no longer believe that there's a self, there still is a remnant of this, of the self-cherishing attitude within their continuum. The classic example, and one that Geshe Dorje mentioned yesterday, was if you were to have, if rather than these beautiful, what are these? Jasmine? Rather than these fragrant jasmine, actually, maybe it would work with this too. If I poured out these jasmine petals and I smelled the bowl, would there still be some scent of the jasmine there? Right? The classic example the Tibetans use is garlic. If this bowl was filled with garlic and you would pour it out, even you would wipe it out, you would still have a, it's sort of the smell had imprinted itself within the glass or the porcelain or the wood or the plastic, whatever the box. Have you experienced like that sometime? In America, we used to use something we call mothballs in the winter. In the spring, we put the woolen things away to keep the moths from coming in, naphthalene, I think, or some other thing like that. So if you were to take out the clothes and all the mothballs, still the drawer that you had been storing these things in would smell of that, right? This is kind of like an analogy for the self-cherishing attitude. Even though the self-grasping has been eliminated from the mind, because of its presence in our mind since beginningless time, it's left some imprint in there. Even for the arhat, if the arhat is given the choice of entering into nirvana or working for the benefit of sentient beings, it enters into nirvana. Because some predisposition to work for one's own welfare, even one doesn't believe there's a self. Well, it's not just a matter of belief. One knows there is no self. One still has this imprint in the mind. So how does one eliminate that imprint in the mind? Is through the application over a long period of time of a combination of bodhicitta, conventional bodhicitta, and the wisdom that realizes emptiness. It's like the scouring pad that can eliminate that self-cherishing attitude, the imprint in the mind of the self-grasping. So that's a special feature of the bodhisattva's practice, because they have bodhicitta. Hinayana practitioners, could a Hinayana practitioner have bodhicitta and not know it and still enter into nirvana? What do you think? Okay, you're expressing opinion. Why not?
They may have the knowledge, but they lack the wisdom.
So you're not turning it on first and testing it. Is it on?
Hello.
Is there a control for the volume of that microphone? Maybe there's no one upstairs. Okay.
I'll try to speak louder.
Yeah. Put it close to your mouth like a rock and roll singer.
I don't want to. Hi.
Hi.
Okay. I think it's because the Hinayana practitioners, they just have the knowledge. Right, the knowledge, but they lack the wisdom of emptiness. the true understanding.
That's what you believe? Yeah. Okay, so different schools have different ideas, different tenets. From the point of view, in fact, we'll be talking later in these courses about the different tenets, from the point of view of the highest philosophical school, which everyone says they're the highest, but which generally accorded the view of the highest view, what's called the Madhyamaka view, that was presented by Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti, and all of the great scholars, which is considered to be the highest view generally amongst all the Tibetans, Japanese. According to that view, even amongst the Madhyamakas, they're different. But according to the Prasangika point of view, even the Hinayana arhats realize emptiness directly. They have to realize emptiness directly. So there's no difference between the Bodhisattva and the Hinayana in terms of their whether or not one realizes emptiness. The realization of emptiness of the Bodhisattva is accompanied by a great accumulation of merit and by the conventional bodhicitta. The Hinayana arhat has apprehension of emptiness, direct realization of emptiness to escape from samsara, accompanied by a much lesser accumulation of merit and accompanied by the support of renunciation, spontaneous renunciation. They don't have bodhicitta. So my question was, could a Hinayana arhat or a Hinayana practitioner who is going along that path, could they have bodhicitta and not realize it? Well, no. Because if they have bodhicitta, their attitude would be one to, if given the opportunity to escape to nirvana or to work, I should put the other way around, nirvana is lesser, right? Lesser goal. To escape, to achieve nirvana or to achieve enlightenment, they would forego, they would give up working for their own nirvana to remain within cyclic existence. Even though cyclic existence is the nature of suffering. So the bodhisattva is someone who has greater renunciation than the Hinayana arhat, is willing to put up with cyclic existence. You know, as I say, for instance, you know, the individuals, you hear so many loving stories of parents who work for their children and to raise their children, to give them money to go to school. The parents work terrible jobs, long hours, 2 or 3 hours. It's almost like that, you know, for seeing some greater benefit for the welfare of others, willing to put up with that suffering. So we've come to this, to a little more explanation of this third principle of the path. The right view of emptiness. Why is it called a right view? First of all, the correct understanding of emptiness. Because there are wrong ways to apprehend emptiness. You know, one can have many misconceptions about what emptiness means. I mentioned in the talk yesterday in the Heart Sutra. You know the Heart Sutra? It's very famous. Shariputra, who is the disciple of the Buddha, the Hinayana disciple of the Buddha, hearer, who was considered to be the Buddha's right hand. Usually if you see a presentation, statue of the Buddha or Tanka, on the Buddha's right, so as you're looking, that would be on your left, is Shariputra, and on the other side is Mahamoggallana. Shariputra was considered by the Buddha, prophesized that he was the foremost of all the Buddhist disciples in wisdom. I should say, not the foremost of all the disciples, foremost of all of his hearer disciples in wisdom. So He's got to know about emptiness, right? From a Prasangika point of view. But he's asking Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara. He's asking him, how do the Bodhisattvas practice the perfection of wisdom? Because he knows how the hearers, the Pratika Buddhas, practice their higher training of wisdom, right? Remember the higher trainings? Ethics, concentration, and wisdom. He knows how to meditate on the selflessness of the person. That's the main object that is mentioned in the Hinayana scriptures. The selflessness of the person. Something called the selflessness of phenomena, or the emptiness of phenomena, doesn't generally occur explicitly in the Hinayana scriptures. Did you know that? From the Mahayana point of view, we talk about all phenomena as being illusion-like, as empty of existing the way that they appear. They are empty. They are empty of inherent existence. But from the Hinayana point of view, it's the person that's the big problem, the apprehension of the person, which is the problem from Mahayana point of view, but it's not the only problem. But it's the thing that's most apparent that is the direct generator of our afflictions. Grasping to the self of persons also gives rise to this self-cherishing attitude. And in tandem, they give rise to attachment, anger, hatred, jealousy, pride, all of the various problematic states of mind, low self-esteem, high self-esteem, which is like pride. So for them, the main thing is to realize that the self is empty, that the self that appears to the mind upon inspection, when someone criticizes you, says, you're a liar, you're a thief, and you say, there's this sense of I-ness, of me, back there somewhere within you, seems to be so real, palpable. The Christian philosophers, when they talked about the soul, I think if anyone's a Christian scholar here, maybe you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was Thomas Aquinas, one philosopher, a Christian philosopher, said, there's no need to prove the existence of the soul, because Christianity talks about the soul, right? Eternal soul that will continue after this lifetime, goes to heaven or hell, generally, or goes to purgatory. There's no need to offer any proofs. It's so obvious. It's so obviously there. Well, that's what Buddhists, Mahayana Buddhists would call apprehending, recognizing the object of negation. And recognizing that it seems so, you know, that's the first step to get a clear apprehension of the self, not the body, not the mind, but a sense of oneself as existing from its own side. Almost the Christians, you know, they've gone that far, but they haven't gotten to the point because it wasn't promulgated by Jesus, let's say, obviously, maybe to some of his disciples, maybe if he had studied in Kashmir, as there were legends that Christ went to Kashmir in the early part of his life before he coming back to the Middle East and studied Mahayana, where one of the epithets of the Bodhisattvas is, you know what the different names of the Bodhisattvas? What's one name of the Bodhisattvas that Christ was used? Actually, the Bodhisattvas are called sons of the Buddha, children of the Buddha. So who Christ was referred to as what? The Son of God, right? He may have referred to himself, or he may have used that expression sometime. So, from the Hinayana point of view, one recognizes this apprehension of the self, this the appearance of a self, not only the appearance of the self, Let's say this is how the self is appearing to the mind. But also one watches the mind itself, the reaction to that, and sees whether the mind is believing in that, is acquiescing to that. Is that a word you know, acquiesce, to go along with, to adhere to that? So we say, I adhere to the rules. That means I go along with the rules. There's some things that appear to our mind that we don't acquiesce to. You know, we know that there's some, say, to someone who's skilled driving on the highway, they know if they see the refraction of the light on the highway, they know that there's no water there once they're skilled in mirage. But oftentimes if something appears, because it appears vividly to us, we acquiesce to that. We grasp to it as true. And it's not so much the appearance of the eye that's the problem, but it's the mind's reaction to that. Oh, yeah, that there is that eye. So this is a little difference in Thomas Aquinas. Maybe he's saying, yeah, that eye does appear there, so there's no need to prove its existence. Because it appears, therefore it exists. He didn't say those words, but I'm implying that that's what he said, right? What did he say? There's something... What's that famous thing in philosophy? Because... Yeah. Is it? I think, it's a different context. I think, therefore, I am. Yeah. So, because there were no teachings in Christianity explicitly about selflessness, it's just assumed the self, the soul, exists and continues on. So from a Hinayana point of view, that's the main goal, to use the various reasonings that logic that can help you understand that there are things that appear that do not exist the way that they appear, first of all, to enter into this. For instance, the reflection in a mirror might cause you to mistake, to think there's really someone there dressed in your dress, and you see that's just your reflection. Or to hear an echo and think that there is actually some sound, source of the sound is out there, whereas actually maybe your own voice that's coming back, or the voice of the bark of the dog that's reflected off the wall. When I was doing retreat in New Mexico many years ago, I went out for a walk and I noticed in the distance, I thought these three dogs were out there, you know, just beyond where I could see clearly. And there have been some naughty dogs around. I didn't want to, you know, aggravate them. So I was just walking a little bit closer. They didn't move. Finally, as I got closer, I realized that there were a couple of stones and support for a water faucet. There were no dogs. Actually, could I say they were empty of dogs? From the distance, before I investigated, they appeared to be dogs, you know, unclearly. But as I got closer, I recognized there were no dogs there. They were devoid of dogs. One of the classic examples the Buddha gave is of a Karen. Is that a word you use here? C-A-I-R-N. Am I pronouncing it right? In England and Scotland, to demarcate the different property lines, junctions, they put a pile of stones, okay, piled up. And if you're walking, trekking in the English countryside and you saw one from the distance, you might think, ah, there's another traveler. Yeah, hey, come. Do you have any water? Do you have any beer? And as you got close, if you thought, oh, they're not responding, they don't hear me, you get closer, you see it is just a pile of stones. But from the distance, because it has the general maybe shape and you have anticipation, you impute upon that as a person. It's empty of being a person. Can you see how I'm applying the word empty here? It's devoid of being a person. Was there ever a person there that was eliminated? No, it was never a person from the beginning. Same thing with this selflessness of the person. When you realize emptiness of the person, it's not as though you've destroyed a person that was really there. And you might be hesitant to meditate on emptiness or selflessness, thinking, I don't want to disappear. If I realize emptiness, I'll destroy myself. So if I realize the emptiness of the Karen, that there's no person there, did I destroy the person that was there? There was never a person there to begin with, right? If I realize that the reflection is empty of being another person, did I kill that person? Should I be arrested by the police? No, there was never a person there to begin with. So this appearance to our mind of a self from the very beginning has never been a self. It's only appeared to be so. And because it appeared to be so, and because of constant familiarity since beginningless time, our mind of ignorance, or self-grasping ignorance, grasps that, adheres to that, acquiesces to that appearance as though, self, me. It may not even have to go through that. It's just so totally obvious. Like who I think was Thomas Aquinas, maybe not that philosopher, just said, oh, of course, the self exists because it appears so clearly. You know, no need to prove it. It's not like some ineffable side of thing. It's just there. That's the object that Buddha realized was actually empty in the sense of appearing to be one thing, but empty of, devoid of being that which it appeared to be. Like a mirage. In the desert, if you see what appears to be water, if I say, can I use the terminology, it is empty of water? Does that make sense to you? Yeah, because there's no water there, right? It appears to be water because maybe the light from the sun is refracted. There's different temperature gradient between the sand and the air. And because of that sharp white light coming to you, it appears to be a reflection off the surface of the water. It's not as though you see the water. You seem to see the reflection off the water and you assume that's water. But it's actually, was there ever water there? No. It's devoid of water. So the Hinayana approach to emptiness is one that mainly talks about the selflessness of the persons. But the Mahayana approach to emptiness is one that Avalokiteshvara explained to Shariputra in the Heart Sutra. Do you know what his initial response when Shariputra says, how do the bodhisattvas meditate on the perfection of wisdom? Do you know what he said? Someone must know from reciting the Heart Sutra so many times. Who knows? You know? You're just changing your glasses. Huh? Okay. Doris, do you know? Kimji. What did Avalokiteshvara say? You don't know? I thought you were there yesterday when I explained in the other class. he said the bodhisattvas meditate on the emptiness of inherent existence of the five aggregates also. What was he talking about? Not just the selflessness of the person, but the five aggregates. What are they? It sounds like five things you get in the supermarket, right? Oh, the five aggregates. What are the five aggregates? Well, they actually, five aggregates. Actually, what's the Indian word we know? Skandhas, right? The Buddha said that if you were to take a chariot apart, you could put all the wooden pieces in one pile, one skandha. you could take all of the leather from the bridles in another part. What other kind of parts? There might be some metal on the rims of the wheels, or the metal in another part, and I'm not sure what else would be parts of the chariot. If you were to take a part of Mercedes-Benz, you'd have more, you'd have some petroleum, some oil, some glass, right? Steel, maybe some mahogany, plastic. You'd have different piles. The Buddha said if you were to deconstruct the person and take it apart in ways that left nothing behind, there would be five piles or five skandhas, five aggregates. So the first most obvious one is the form aggregate. So all of your body, you know, all of the fluids, the good stuff and the bad stuff go in one pile. It's called the form aggregate. The other four are all aspects of the mind. So two of them are called the aggregate of feelings, all of the feelings. And here feelings doesn't mean, as people in the West sometimes say, oh, he has feelings for other beings, he has feelings for dogs, you know, emotions. That's not the meaning of feeling. Feeling means the experience of pleasure, pain, or indifference. When you experience being bitten, or you're embraced by your loved ones, you know, some pleasant feeling, you get a nice massage or whatever, cool breeze, you feel a pleasant feeling. Someone praises you, you're happy, happy feeling, pleasant feeling of mind. So feelings, discriminations, so the ability... discriminations means the ability to discriminate from one thing from another in a very loose way. All of the other mental factors, such as attachment, hatred, are in the fourth aggregate we call compositional factors. Those factors that help us compose karma. Main one is a mental factor called intention. Anyway, all of these are mental phenomena. And then the last one is just our primary consciousnesses. The primary consciousness of eye, which doesn't make decisions, just sort of acts like a receptor of ear, nose, taste, touch, and of the mental consciousness. Here we're not talking about the ability of the mental consciousness to make decisions, but just its bare faculty of being clear and knowing. So these, if you take apart the person and you distribute them into these five piles, there's nothing left. You might think that the person, as you're investigating, when you first notice the person, seems so palpable, so touchable, you know, so true right there. You would think that if you took away these five things, there'd be something left. The self would be left hovering there in space, the soul. But there is nothing left when you take away these five aggregates, if you analyze through that way. So that's the context of the five aggregates. So generally, in the Hinayana tradition, we would, if you were to ask... So the self does not exist. You know, the self appears, but is actually empty of existing the way that it appears, right? But if you were to ask the form aggregate, the body, does the form aggregate exist? The answer would be what? Yes, it does exist. It's the basis for labeling the person. The person is labeled. The conventional person, which you could say nominally exists, is labeled upon the body, the feelings, the discriminations, the compositional factors, and the consciousness. Five aggregates. But the five aggregates upon which it's labeled, they do exist. Like this. An army. You know what an army is? You have an idea? is one, so an army is labeled onto a collection of soldiers, and maybe you add their equipment, their horses or whatever, is labeled upon that. Can you, if you take away all of the soldiers, the horses, the chariots or whatever, armored vehicles, you take away, is there any army left? No, you can't find the army. This is a little bit like looking for the person within the aggregates. But still, when you look at this group of people, you would say, well, yeah, that's the army. Where did it go? You know, it must be there somewhere. So army is just a name that we designate to those collection of parts. And there is that is a conventionally existent phenomena, nominally existent, that which is accepted by people as existing, but doesn't have a real existence. But if you ask the people, it's what's called designatedly existent. It's just imputedly existent, according to the Hinayana, the army. But if you look at the soldiers and you ask, does the soldier exist? What would they say? Yeah, come on, yeah, the soldier exists. I can see he's right there. But if you were to go in that other step and taking the soldier apart, you know, you couldn't find the soldier anywhere in there. So what Avalokiteshvara was saying to Shariputra, the bodhisattvas meditate not only on the selflessness of the person, but they meditate on the basis of that person, the five aggregates. All of those also are empty of inherent existence. All phenomena can be included in the five, all impermanent phenomena can be included in the five aggregates. So the view of emptiness is one that encompasses not only the emptiness of the self of persons, but also the emptiness of what could be called the self of phenomena. Does that sound awkward to say the self of phenomena? It's like usually we use the word self to refer to people, right? Does an avocado have a self? If you like avocados, it definitely does. Oh, yeah. That avocado has a real self back there. So the sense of self means the sense of some kind of existence from its own side, as though it would be findable there. It has a real soul or essence, self-existence. The Mahayana point of view of emptiness is that not only is the self empty of appearing the way it exists, also all other phenomena are empty of existing the way that they appear. Now, someone mentioned before, so that it has to be clarified. Generally, in the Hinayana scriptures, it doesn't mention the self of phenomena. It just mentions the self of the person, right? So you might think that they don't realize the emptiness of the self of phenomena. But according to the highest philosophical view, they do realize that. By the way, as they are meditating on the selflessness of the person, but they take as their main object of observation the selflessness, emptiness of the self of persons. So these three principles of the path, renunciation, the Mahayana equivalent of renunciation, you might say, bodhicitta, the altruistic mind aiming for enlightenment, and the right view of emptiness that sees all phenomena as empty of inherent existence, and as a result acts as an antidote to the basic ignorance that causes us to remain in cyclic existence. It acts as an antidote to the ignorance that grasps to inherent existence. One sees it is actually, the self is actually empty of existing the way that it appears. And one is freed. Incredible sense of, when one has an insight into emptiness, it is said that one has an incredible sense of liberation just there. All of the worries that one had, all of the guilt trips you had, I did this, I did that, I didn't make mom happy, dad happy, I didn't become a lawyer, or I became a lawyer but a lousy lawyer, or whatever. All of the things that you regret, you realize there was no self, there was no you that created those actions. In fact, this is one of the most powerful ways to purify negative karma. If you're doing Vajrasattva retreat or prostrations to the 35 Buddhas, doing the applying the four opponent forces to purify negative karma, to spend some time meditating on the emptiness of the self. Think of the karma that you've created, and think of yourself as the creator of that negative karma that you want to confess, you want to purify, and realize at the time you created that karma, you were believing in a self of persons. Believing there was a real I findable there, that was the cause of your anger, or the cause of your attachment to steal, or the cause of your pride where you developed some arrogance with respect to my possessions or my qualities. When you realize that there's no self at all, and there was never any self there from the beginning, it's like all of that can, almost you can let go of that. You know, the sense that there was any karma, there was no person who created those actions. So having that apprehension, although the karmic instinct is in your mind, that karmic instinct now diminishes in its potency and its intensity. If you were to have not even a direct realization of emptiness, even an intellectually correct realization of emptiness with the union of calm abiding and special insight on the path of preparation, all of those karmic seeds lose their efficacy. So it's one of the most powerful ways to do purification, to meditate on emptiness, and to look back at the actions and think the person that created that, you know, at that time, they may be actions that you remember doing. So who I thought I was when I said those harsh words to the teacher or my parents, or when I took this or I stole that or I cheated here or whatever. That person never existed from the beginning, even though I was completely convinced at the time, acquiesced, accepted that was a real self. So there was no person that was creating those actions. When you have an understanding of that, the karmic imprints of your mind lose their potency, lose their ability to bring about the great negative effects that they could bring about. It doesn't mean you won't experience any negative effects, because it doesn't purify everything from the very beginning. Even, I think, Mahau Moggallana, you know, the disciple, the Buddha's left, who was considered to be foremost in what? Magical powers, right? The Riddhis. Near the end of his life, I'm not sure, Jain or other Nigrantha disciples, non-Buddhist disciples, came to him and said, "Oh, our master has died. Where has he been reborn?" Hoping to hear some good news, you know, he's been born in heaven or something like this. And Moggallana, not to mince words, you know, just to tell it as it is, you know, say, oh, I see with my clairvoyance he's been born in the deepest hells. And these disciples who had great faith, they were kind of like someone looking for the reincarnation of a lama, you know, say, where has he been reborn? And, you know, in Singapore and Tibet. And, no, he's been born in hell. You know, completely. So they attacked Mahamudgalyana and beat him to a pulp. And at that point, he experienced some suffering, right? But he didn't, because he was already an arhat, he no longer had an apprehension of the self. He didn't have the same reaction to that as we would. You know, he's not bemoaning the fact, but there was still experience of some suffering within this continuum. But it's just like the story of the Buddha, when the Buddha was ill once with a fever, and there were some of the disciples there bathing him. You know, he was lying on his cot, and they were putting cold compress on him and asking him, how does the Buddha feel? And the Buddha said, there are great waves of pain passing through the body, through the Buddha's body, kind of speaking in the third person, right? You know, through the Buddha's body. There are great waves of pain passing through the Buddha's body, but his mind is at ease. That's kind of like what was happening to Mahamudgalyana. Actually, the Buddha, there were no waves of pain because he had gone beyond even the state of arhatship to Buddhahood. And the Buddha never experiences an iota of pain. Everything is experienced in the one taste of great bliss. So he was just giving an illustration of the arhat's experience. So we could maybe, with a little bit of understanding of impermanence and emptiness, selflessness and so forth, when we're caught in some situation that might have irritated us tremendously in another part of our life, we might be able to say the same thing. Someone calls you on the phone and they say, how are you doing? You say, oh, it's a big hassle at the airport. You know, I'm going through all sorts of complications. They're checking my luggage. My ticket has been canceled, but my mind is at ease. Do you think you could do that? Yeah. That would be a good demarcation that you've achieved some. You know, you don't have to be arhat to have that. You know, to have that kind of, you know, to see through all of these things. So between the two. Let's say, leave apart renunciation for the present. Between the two, bodhicitta and the wisdom that realizes emptiness, which one is more, or let's say emptiness itself, here, the object of the wisdom, between the goal of bodhicitta, or bodhicitta was explained to you, and emptiness, which is more difficult to understand? We may have talked about this in this class before. I can't remember. Yeah. Which is more difficult to understand? Good. Someone's thinking. I can tell by who's looking at. What did you think? What did you conclude? Guram. What was your name again? This gentleman? Was it? You tell me his name. I can't hear.
My name is Beng Leong.
Beng Gil.
I recall you were saying that it's hard to understand emptiness, and but the concept is easy to grasp the concept of bodhicitta, but vice versa is the other way around also for both.
This microphone doesn't help me at all. Does it help? Can you hear through the microphone? Or emptiness. Yeah, so I think you're right. So emptiness is more difficult, intimidating, because we're not quite sure. It's not something which is what's called an obvious phenomena, emptiness. It's what's called a deeply hidden phenomena. Is it? Deeply hidden? No, it's not a deeply hidden phenomena. It's what's called a hidden phenomena. There are three kinds of phenomena. And this is another way of cutting up the pizza of phenomena. Remember, say impermanent, impermanent, contaminated, uncontaminated. You can cut up phenomena into obvious phenomena or manifest phenomena, hidden phenomena, and deeply hidden phenomena. So what are obvious phenomena or manifest phenomena? Phenomena that can be apprehended through the senses without the need of any logic. You don't have to be told about the mug. You can just look at it. The mug is there, right? It manifests itself to your senses. Example of hidden phenomena. At first hidden would be the existence of fire in the smoky kitchen. You don't see the flames of the fire, but you can. It's hidden to your direct perception at first. If you don't walk, I mean, but it's capable of being known. So it's not. This is just an analogy of a hidden phenomena. But from the distance, as you're looking at the house, and someone says, "The house is on fire," you say, "I don't see any fire." But if you see smoke billowing out of the windows of the kitchen, you can infer through your experience that where there's smoke, there is fire, right? Do you have an expression like that? We have something like that, right? How do you say in Singapore, how do you say in Singlish? In English we say, where there's smoke, there's fire. So even though you don't see the fire, you can infer the existence of fire and know unambiguously that there is fire there, right? Same thing with emptiness, with subtle impermanence, other kinds of phenomena that are cut off from our direct perception at first. They too can be known with direct perception eventually, just as you can know the fire existing in the kitchen. If you walk over to the house, you can see the fire, or you can just wait until the whole house catches fire and you see the flames. In the same way, emptiness can be known directly once it has been inferred through logic. So it is called a hidden phenomena. It is hidden from from manifesting to our senses from the beginning. Even when you realize emptiness with a reason, logically, you don't perceive it with your eye, ear, nose, taste, or touch. You perceive it with your mental consciousness. Buddha's different. Buddha's every sense perceives everything, even his eyes, his ears, his touch perceive all phenomena. But we're talking about ordinary beings. Yeah, you have a question? You're just scratching. So emptiness is something. So just to finish up the pie, the third category of phenomena, deeply hidden phenomena. What's the example of that? Karma? Who said? You said? Good try. Actually, the connection, the general connection of karma, that ethics leads to high rebirth, or generosity leads to receiving the resources in the future, the karmic results, that's not deeply hidden. That can be inferred. That's maybe hidden phenomena. But a deeply hidden phenomena related to karma is the exact connection, stealing this, what is this called again? Jasmine. Stealing this jasmine flower now, what result will that have in the future? Exact result. Time, date, existence, under what circumstances. Only that can be known by the omniscient mind. You can't infer. If you go fishing and you catch a fish, you may be able to infer that the person who's killed the fish will end up with certain karmic consequences, one of which might be a hare lip and other things, being born in the hell realms. But But you can't know when that will happen. You can't know if the person will purify that karma before it ripens. Only the Buddha, the omniscient mind, can know. So that it's the subtle details of karma that are example of a deeply hidden phenomena. Also, there are other examples of deeply hidden phenomena. But say the qualities of the Buddha that the Buddha did not explain, or that even the bodhisattvas cannot perceive with their perception, because the Buddha is of a higher status. Generally, with clairvoyance, it's said that you can know the minds of others who are of your level or lower spiritual level, but you can't necessarily know the mind with clairvoyance of those who are at a higher spiritual level to you. So the bodhisattvas, even the 10th level bodhisattvas before they achieve enlightenment, they can't know the mind of the Buddha the way that it actually exists, like with clairvoyance, seeing directly. So for them, those would be deeply hidden phenomena also. Okay. So this is a little presentation of the three principal aspects of the path. You could find a very, very tasty way of saying all of my practice should be dedicated to working on developing these three qualities: a real, heartfelt, authentic renunciation of cyclic existence. That's going to help us very much today, this lifetime, recognizing there's no real pleasure to be found here. So don't go overboard when you go home tonight. You know, don't tell your wife or husband, you know, that there's no real pleasure to be found here in this house. You know, his wife makes your husband makes a nice dinner waiting for you at home. Not like the Gandantipa. It's all suffering. No, be appreciative. It's right now we're not at that point, but to look at life's vicissitudes, the ups and downs of life within this understanding, and try to intensify it. If you have a chance to do retreat, to meditate on renunciation, to meditate every day and try to enhance what bodhicitta you have. Bodhicitta is based on compassion for sentient beings, which itself is based on a heartwarming affection for them, which comes about from understanding how kind they've been to us in the past. Also understanding how we are exactly equal to them, identifying with them. You know, there's no being that wants to suffer. There's no being that wants that has had enough happiness. You know, there's no one that you know is okay, I've had enough. Give all the happiness to everyone else. We always want more, right? We're never satisfied. It's one of the basic sufferings. of cyclic existence, the suffering of dissatisfactoriness. So one can enhance one's sense of affection for sentient beings by identifying with them, that we're equal with them, the equality of self and others. That's a very profound reason. And for those who are said to be followers of reasoning, who have sharp intellect, who are not just followers of faith, it is said that the individual can develop bodhicitta more rapidly through that method of developing affection for others, recognizing the equality of self and others, and then eventually working for the benefit of others in the same way that we work for the benefit of the self now. And the third aspect of the path, the correct understanding of emptiness, recognizing that emptiness is not something special. Emptiness is everywhere, even kaka. It's a baby talk for excrement, right? Even kaka has emptiness as its nature. Everything has emptiness as its nature. So it's not to be something rare, but what is rare is the right understanding of emptiness, the wisdom that realizes emptiness. Let's say the prajna paramita, the perfection of wisdom. That's rare and precious and valuable. That's what can bring about liberation and can bring about enlightenment in conjunction with either renunciation or bodhicitta. Sometimes it's mentioned that another name for the bodhisattva's realization of emptiness is ultimate bodhicitta. So this is the mind, altruistic mind, wishing to achieve enlightenment is called conventional bodhicitta, because it's dealing with the conventional apprehension of conventional phenomena. And the wisdom that realizes emptiness in the continuum of a bodhisattva is called ultimate bodhicitta. We wouldn't call the realization of emptiness in the mind of a Hinayana arhat ultimate bodhicitta. Because ultimate bodhicitta means the realization of emptiness within the mind stream of someone who has conventional bodhicitta. If you have conventional bodhicitta in your mind, then your realization of emptiness is called ultimate bodhicitta. Whereas in the Hinayana, in the mind stream of a Hinayana, they don't have conventional bodhicitta, so that's not called, their realization of emptiness is not called ultimate bodhicitta. So let me stop there and leave some time for questions, which I neglected to do this morning. I'm sorry. So, yes. Nice and loud. Project your voice. You should leave it on now. Don't turn it off when you move it around. Question?
Yes, Venerable George.
Yes.
It's regarding the space light meditation on the clear light mind that you teaches us. Okay, during the meditation, as the thought arises, and then we should let it go. Okay, but while before we let it go, we actually follow the thoughts. Due to it appears very real to us, then we believe in it, then we really truly feel that it exists. So we keep on following until we remind ourselves that, about it does not exist truly from its own side. Then we based on the emptiness analysis, then we will let it go, because as you teach us, while doing breathing, the thought arise, let it go. Thought arise, let it go. Most of the time, for myself, my problem is, it did not go.
It will not go.
Yeah,
yeah, right. So that's good observation. So could you hear what he said? Was loud enough? So when you're meditating on the meditation we did at the beginning, clear light nature of the mind,
yes.
I had said that if thoughts come, just to let go of them. So it's sort of like if you're on an important phone call and someone is coming up to you and trying to say something to you, you sort of turn away from them, right? You know, go away. Give them some dismissal symbol, you know, get out of my face. So you can kind of turn your attention when the thought is there. You can either just remind yourself not to pay attention to that, not to get involved with that, or to actually turn your attention to something else. Ask yourself at that particular time, what is the consciousness which is apprehending this thought? So the consciousness that is apprehending the thought is different than the thought itself. So it's almost like turning your head around away from the objective thought and focusing instead on the subjective mind that's perceiving it. But they're different. But that, at first, when those thoughts are present, there may seem to be no method to let go of those thoughts. In fact, they may seem to be coming more rapidly than usual. That's the experience of people when they do this meditation at the beginning. It's a little bit like this. If we were to stand out in Sims Avenue here, and I would ask you to count the cars, you might, as you start counting the cars, so there's several coming at one time, and you just keep track, you might say, there's so many, there's not usually so many cars. Well, there's usually there's many cars, but you don't pay attention to them, right? So same thing with the thoughts. These thoughts are constantly there. When you take your attention away from partially paying attention out here, when all these thoughts are all, the traffic is always going through their mind, and now you turn your attention to the mind itself, and you see that, you apprehend that, it might appear to you like that. Oh, this meditation you're talking to me, trying to teach me to calm the mind, is causing more thoughts. It's not causing more thoughts. You're just observing them now. They were there all the time. So now the question is, how can you, so you have to sit for some time and let the mind calm down. What are some strategies to let go of the thoughts? Besides just saying, let go, how can you actually do? Look at the space. There might be some moments between individual thoughts. One thought might disappear and another one comes. Some instant of time. And you remind yourself, oh, that's space. That's what I want to apprehend. Then maybe later as your mind is calming down, a little longer, hold that, and then another thought comes. Eventually, as the frequency of the thoughts, new thoughts coming, diminishes, and their intensity, that is, how strongly they're appearing to you, also diminishes. You can find strategies to do what you can say, let go. You know, this thought, I'm not going to pay attention to it. But if you're not paying attention to the thought, you have to be paying attention to something else. So what you want to be paying attention to is the space around the thoughts. So even the thoughts are there. Here is, I think, a very powerful method Lama Yeshe used to explain. Even the thoughts are there, right in your face, right? Knowing that the only way that that thought could be there, appearing, is if there's spaciousness of the mind for it to be embedded in. And sort of like, just at that instant, you take your attention away from the objective thought into the understanding that there's space there, and already the thought, if you can hold that space for the sense that there's space there, the thought itself begins to evaporate, so to speak. Once at a meditation course in Italy, when Lama taught the six yogas of Naropa Lama Yeshe, one of the monks at the time, no longer a monk, but still puttering around the Dharma, his name Piero. Lama asked Piero how it was going. Piero was in charge of the discipline of the monastics at the course. And Piero, in very Italian style, said, Lama, my mind is so everywhere, you know, this is completely, you know, I can't meditate on the clear light nature. And Lama said, looked very, very stern, and said, that's the best time. You know, all of these things, like airplanes flying through your mind, you know, like war taking place, bombs going on, you know, anger coming, you know, different things you're worried about. Just to let go at that moment, just to recognize within all of this is appearing within the spaciousness of my mind. And just all of that stuff is there one instant, and the next instant, letting go, just a slight change of perspective, seeing the spaciousness, and all of those things can start to diminish. Then you have to continue. It's not as though that frenetic thoughts that are coming cease immediately. If you're a very proficient meditator, maybe you can cause them to diminish very quickly. If you realize, if you've had some insight into emptiness, even if you haven't realized it, just an insight into it is like pouring cold water on the hot, boiling mind, you know, just everything, it's okay. Doesn't matter. Once when I was at Koban, there was one lady, a Western lady, maybe she was French, or maybe American, she had offered to Lama to make 21 Tara statues. So what she did was she's going to use the lost wax process. Do you know what that is? Can you make a statue? You make the statue out of wax. So the artist makes the general and then puts on the ornaments. It was of Tara. So making ornaments and the head knot and the ornaments and different things on the body and the fingers and the upala flowers and everything. And sort of looks sort of brownish gray. And she had this in a cardboard box she was going to take to Delhi or some other place where they take the wax. Do you know what I'm talking about? Some of you? Does no one knows what I'm talking about? How they make statues? You know. So you would first put in something like plaster. Maybe they have better things now. And then what? And the wax is lost. You could heat that either in the oven or with water or something. And once it is solidified around the wax, the wax is lost as you heat that mold. And then what you're left is a negative. The Tara statue there is in their reverse. So then you pour into that the substance, whether brass or copper or whatever, and you end up. And at the end, you break the plaster, and you're left with a positive image of the statue, right? In simplification. So anyway, she had left in a taxi to go off to have this done. And a couple of days later, I think I was leading a meditation course. I can't remember, but I looked under the Bodhi tree at Koban, and there was the box that the Tara statue had been in underneath the Bodhi tree. And I looked. I opened it up. And there was the statue, except it had been out in the heat now for, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 days, and all of the parts had fallen off. You know, the ear, the part of the head had fallen off, and all of these ornaments and everything. And it was like, I brought it upstairs, and Lama Zopa Rinpoche was up having his breakfast on the veranda with Lama Yeshe. And I showed it to Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and Rinpoche was going, oh, no, Tara. It's falling apart, you know. And Lama Yeshe, Lama Zopa was sometimes kind of like the fall guy. You know what I mean by fall guy? In a comedy team, you know, and to allow the other person to get the line or sort of like, so Lama Zopa's freaking out, you know. And Lama Yeshe says, doesn't matter, Zopa. So like the wisdom, you know, like all this chaos is going on, like in your mind, you know. Like in Piero's mind, doesn't matter. Realizing the emptiness behind this, all of this is just appearance. So if you have that kind of apprehension, that can very instantly help you to let go of these thoughts. Someone else have a question? No, this gentleman, yeah. Yeah, project. You're Caucasian. You're not afraid to talk. Singapore.
Venerable, yes. You work, for example, in coaching and business analytics.
When I work in what?
When you work in coaching, business, for example, we know that because there is no further eye, for example, when someone comes and has a lot of negative emotions, we know that the root of those emotions are grasping to the eye. Mm-hmm. Because we have been stuck. However, if a particular individual who is not being trained on the Dharma, say, comes with this approach, we would like to help that person to realize.
We use what?
We would like to help that person to realize that thought. But it's not that easy. What would be a beginner's approach for a nice
Could you understand what he said? You couldn't understand his English, right? Yeah, good. So he's saying that, you know, for us, we've been hearing these talks that these emotions come about because of the belief in the apprehension of this I that doesn't really exist, but does definitely appear. It appears to our mind, like in a reflection, like an echo, whatever, like a Karen, like an illusion, but it's actually never been a person there in that way, findable. How can we introduce that to someone who has not been, had not had this introduced before? So it's a little bit because emptiness is something that is very subtle, it's a hidden phenomena, and it's something that, if misapprehended, can be very dangerous. The example I gave one day was that, like the serpents, snakes, if you're not skilled in snakes, with poisonous snakes, if you hold, say, for instance, if you grab this cobra by the tail, the cobra's head can come and bite you, right? So in the same way, you have to, I'm not sure exactly, but I'm told you have to grab by the, just below the head so it can't bite you, you know. There's some way of handling snakes. This is an example that's given in the Buddhist scriptures that if misapprehended, mishandled, one can be led into thinking, oh, it doesn't matter, nothing exists, so I'm going to kill. I'm going to steal. This is all empty. Oh, now I'm going to have sex with everyone. I'm going to, you know, cheat on my diet. but it's, that would be having misapprehended the meaning of emptiness, right? So you have to be careful. And it's not everyone that is a receptacle to put the nectar of the teachings in. So at first, when the Buddha taught, the Buddha didn't teach emptiness from the very beginning to people. And Bodhisattva Charyavatara, the chapter on wisdom, as I mentioned before, the Shantideva says, all of these other practices were taught to get to here, to get to the presentation of emptiness. So you teach about relative truth, karma, the law of cause and effect. What you're doing, these bad actions you're creating, will have results for you in the future. You know, you will experience suffering and bad reputation, you won't be loved, and so forth. Teaching them successively to understand certain truths, which are conventionally true, and then the opportunity may arise later to be able to present emptiness, but it's not necessary to present it from the very beginning. But if you were to ask me if there are people that might be, you know, possible, we say vessels, receptacles for, how can you first? So what? I remember Venerable Sanghi Khandro, who was here recently. Some of you know Venerable Sanghi Khandro. Once she asked Lama Yeshe, how can we meditate? How can we get an idea of emptiness? How can we meditate on emptiness? I remember Lama, this was a very long, long time ago. Lama said, oh dear Sanghi Khandro, because she sounded so fragile. I think. Dear Sanghi Khandro, best thing you can do is just recognize how often we mistake things in the world. We think things are a certain way, when it turns out later we find out they're not that way. We think it's 4 o'clock, or like I was telling Ian, who was helping me in the kitchen upstairs earlier, said, oh, this is as long as we can have lunch by, say, 1:30. I'll be able to be to class by 2. And she said, no, class is at 1:30. So I was, in my mind, class today was at 2. You know? sometimes we may think a certain direction is the way that you go, and you find out that's not the correct direction at all. But here's the example. Indian train station. No, maybe it's not a good example. I can't remember exactly what. So you let's say, for instance, you find out that someone you thought didn't like you actually always admired you. There's so many examples in life of things that we're certain of something, and we find out later that we were not correct in that assumption. That they, so what Lama was getting at was that just to start to prepare the mind to realize that the way that reality does exist does not necessarily have to occur to agree with how we think it exists now. The way that we think things are may not be correct at all. So to introduce that to people. Then slowly to introduce the similes that the Buddha gave about emptiness, how things, the appearance within a mirror or in a clear, calm lake that are reflected. And those are good examples. You can say, look at that. It looks like the moon down there, but actually that's the moon up there. There's no moon down in the lake, but it looks so captivatingly real. The animals sometimes come and, you know, there are many anecdotes about that. You know, the animals captivated by that. Or who is it? Some mythological person who was enamored with their own... Narcissus. I can recommend a good book if you haven't read Narcissus and Goldemund. Have you ever read Narcissus and Goldemund? Oh, you've read. By whom? Hermann Hesse, right? Who wrote Siddhartha and many other books. Narcissus and Goldemund came to mind recently because a friend of mine who I went to Copan with in 1974 has since then led this very wild life, kind of like Narcissus. I can't remember which one. There are two friends, that childhood friends, and as they grow up, one becomes a monk, and one goes off and leads this life, a very exciting life with pleasures and pains, and you know, very very interesting Dharma book, if you get a chance to read. Hermann Hesse was the author. So I've gone a little over. Would we go to 3:30 or 3? 3:30. So kind of okay. I haven't gone over yet. Okay. So another question. And just remind me of your name, sir.
Hi.
What's he saying? The acoustics coming this way are not very good.
I.
What is it?
F A R I.
M A I I.
F A R I.
Mari.
With an F at the beginning. Like.
Is it? M A I. F.
F. Yeah.
A.
R.
I. Fari. Sorry, Fari. I'm very sorry. Acoustics are not good. Somehow, before the next class, who's holding the microphone? Sometime before the next class, try to calibrate so the amplifier of the microphone is greater. Make sure there's a new battery. And keep it on. Just put your hand over. Yes. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just want to ask this question. This morning before we start, we have a small little meditation,
yes,
right?
Sir.
And then I remember you say that we use the mind as the object of
yes.
the meditation. So who is the observer?
Ah, okay. You got to hear his question? Who is the observer? So different ways of understanding it. Generally, we say who. We might be thinking of a person. So you, and what is your name? After it took so long with Fadi. What is your name?
Steven.
Oh, that's easy. Good. And did you see Fadi, what he did? He went, Steven, not Fadi. He's got more gumption. I thought the Caucasians had all the uninhibited sort of. So you might think, I could say Stephen is observing, but you say, well, Stephen, this is the whole thing. Stephen when we talk about the self, there's no real findable Stephen, but there is a Stephen that's just merely labeled onto your body and mind, because everyone would agree that knows you. If I say, where's Stephen? They would say he's at ABC. And then someone comes to ABC and says, where's Stephen? He's like, oh, he's up in the Gompa listening to the talk. And then if they come in the room and say, who is Stephen? And people would point, that's Stephen. Everyone says, that's Stephen. If you go within your body and mind, you can't find anything that is sort of findable Stephen. But just to the point where we point to Stephen, that's what's called conventional analysis. That's legitimate. That Stephen does exist just as an appellation, just as a name, a designation to your body and mind. So we say, who is watching the mind? Because that's the word you used, I think. You said, who is watching the mind? Not what is watching the mind. Who is watching the mind? Stephen is watching the mind. The merely imputed Stephen. So in this case, main object of imputation of Stephen is on the consciousness. Stephen, what is watching the mind? Is one part of the mind, like a spy in a room, is watching the rest of the mind, part of your mind. And if you get very, very technical, you might you might argue that according to the Prasangika philosophy, mind cannot know itself, like a sword cannot, like mind cannot apprehend itself, like a sword, one edge of a sword cannot cut itself. You might try to argue that if you bend the sword, you know what I'm saying? But it's not like that. You can't just cut a part of the sword with the sword. You could cut another sword with a sword, right? So that's sometimes given, Shantideva gave example to contradict the Chittamatra philosophy that says there's something called self-cognizing awareness, that the mind has the facility of knowing itself. But here we're not saying that. It's that one part of the mind is watching the rest of the mind. But even then you have to say one instant of the mind now at time, let's call it time 61 seconds. One instant of the mind now is watching the rest of the mind as it was 1 second before, 1 instant before. Because it doesn't, if it were to know it's the rest of the mind at the same time as itself, that would be something like self-cognizing awareness. Anyway, this is technical. Some people may have heard something about that may be useful, but if not, don't worry. So one part of the mind basically is watching the rest of the mind. And just being aware of the contents of the mind, like just right now here, watching this thing, being aware of the people sitting here, and then occasionally not focusing only on the people, defocusing on them and watching the space between the people, or say the space between the thoughts. So basically what is happening is a little portion of your attention is going to be reserved for, dedicated for watching the rest of the mind. Okay. So mind is observing mind, and because you had phrased it who rather than what is watching the mind, I'd have to say Stephen, because generally the who is a personal pronoun. So Stephen is watching the mind, the Stephen that's imputed upon the consciousness, and it's one part of the consciousness that is observing the rest of the consciousness. Okay? It might appear at certain time, after some time, that the mind is knowing itself, but in reality, one instant of mind is knowing the previous instant of mind, the clear and knowing nature of the mind. Okay. Now, do you have a follow-up? Okay. Yes, so you get, like at the news conference, you get a follow-up.
No, I got another question.
Okay.
Earlier you mentioned about the precept of no killing, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and you also mentioned that the so-called consciousness exists indefinitely over a continuum, right? That means there's life after life in different forms,
right?
So technically speaking, if it is such, then technically you can't kill a person.
I caught everything except the last word. Okay. Technically, it is.
Technically speaking,
yeah.
There's no killing because you cannot kill a being.
You can kill a being because a being. A being is not imputed upon the whole continuum. A being is imputed upon one segment of that continuum when they're in a particular realm that has been brought about because of some throwing karma, say animal realm, or fish, or human, or God, or something. That portion of the continuum, mental continuum, is embedded in this appearance and existence as some form within the six realms. So you can sever the life force. It doesn't. Killing is not severing the mental continuum, the subtle consciousness that continues from life to life. Killing means severing the life force. So there's something called, in Tibetan we say sok, was it, I think, in Sanskrit, jiva, that even plants have life force. They don't have consciousness, but they have life force. They come about, become causes. They live. We say they're living things, right? We use that expression. But they're not sentient beings from a Buddhist perspective. Some people think plants are thinking. You know, they think from a Buddhist perspective, that's not right. But anyway, we can debate about that sometime. So the definition of killing is not severing the consciousness, but severing the life force. So if you were to cut into a bunch of flowers and cut them off to offer them to bring to your family or friends or something, or to offer, you're severing the life force of those plants. Would you say the plant was killed? Well, maybe if the roots are still there, some plants will grow back. Others will, once you've cut off the upper part, they'll wither and die. I don't know, those of you who are horticulturists will know the difference. But killing is generally referred to as severing the life force of a sentient being. So it doesn't mean severing this consciousness. So there's a distinction to be made here. The consciousness that continues from beginningless time until now in my continuum and will continue in the future has various segments. Sometimes I've been in the hell realms. There was a consciousness, a gross consciousness there of being a hell being and experiencing vast things. There was an animal, period of animal, and ghost, and again hell. Most of the time I've been in the hells, I'm sure. You know, I'm not... pretty naughty guy, okay? So, but beyond those individual segments of gross consciousness, there has been a subtle thread of consciousness through all of them. It's impossible to sever that. That consciousness has continued from beginningless time to the present, will continue in whatever lifetime. The gross consciousnesses are individual instances from that subtle consciousness, say when we're reborn, at the time when from an intermediate state being entering into a fertilized egg, let's say in the mother's womb, say human. At that point, that subtle consciousness and the subtle mount of that consciousness, that which propels the consciousness, which are inseparable, we call prana or Chinese qi, the subtle kind of qi. That combination is indestructible. It's never separated from one another. That subtle most consciousness enters into the fertilized egg if it has a karmic relationship with those beings. and then starts to, that subtle consciousness remains as it is, but starts to send out grosser versions of consciousness as the embryo begins to evolve. There is a gross mental consciousness, let's say, of being a human. Or if one were to be born in hell without being born in an egg, fertilized egg, one is spontaneously born in hell, one immediately has, from that subtle consciousness, which still remains, it's unaltered, subtle consciousness remains, but because of now entering into this situation karmically, a gross consciousness as though it comes from that subtle consciousness. And at the time of death, that gross consciousness absorbs back into that subtle consciousness. So that gross consciousness of any one lifetime is something that's temporary. So you could say, even though the definition of killing generally is said to be to sever the continuum of life force, you could say it's to sever the continuum of a gross consciousness, although there might be some difficulty with that, because generally if you sever the life force, let's say of a human, their gross consciousness reabsorbs to the subtle consciousness and it has disappeared. But generally, consciousness is not something that you can, because it's immaterial, it's not something you can sever, you can cut. Whereas life force has some relationship with the winds and the prana, and so you can sever that. Does that help a little bit?
Yeah, so can I just follow up on that?
Okay.
Actually, when I say technically you can't kill, I'm referring to the starter consciousness that you're talking about.
So I didn't catch all the words. You're so excited.
We can't kill, I'm referring to what you just mentioned, the starter consciousness that we cannot sever. And if we cannot sever the starter consciousness, then what's the purpose of the precept non-killing?
Precept of non-killing. What's the purpose? Is that in severing the life force of someone, a sentient being, that is an action. And whether you are doing it out of compassion, like euthanasia, or whether you are doing it out of ignorance, offering the goat on the altar, thinking that you will make the gods happy, or whether you're doing it out of anger, you know, you shoot the dog, or you put out poison to the cockroaches, or you go fishing. I was going to say fishing, maybe not out of anger, out of attachment, and you chop off the head, completely ignorant of the karmic consequences. It is said that in severing an action which severs the life force of other sentient beings creates the karma of killing, which will have repercussions upon our continuum in the future. Karmic consequences, various consequences, being born in the lower realms, maybe many, many times, having the tendency of killing easily again in the future, having that habit energy ripening. Oh, yeah, killing, yeah, it's not so bad. Having the karma of being killed once you're born in some realm. Maybe you're born as a fish and thousands of times you'll be killed again and again as a result of that one act of killing. So there's various karmic consequences of that. So that's why the precept was, you know, offered by the Buddha out of compassion, realizing that people, in order to cut the continuity of negative actions, which are like habitual, that we've done since beginningless time, the way to cut the continuity of those is that you have to consciously abstain from those actions with a virtuous motive. And in so doing, you begin to diminish the inertia of that urge to kill. That's why people take the precepts for 24 hours or the lay precepts or particularly the vows of a monk or nun this lifetime. Because that of the various karmic consequences, the most difficult one to purify is the habitual effect. Having stolen, you're going to steal again. You know, you create the karma to inertia in your mind stream in future lifetimes to steal or to lie or to kill or to whatever negative action. So the 10, let's say the 7 actions of body and speech are the ones that we make vows to abstain. Generally in the vows, the pratimoksha vows, which include the lay vows and the vows of the monks and nuns, the pratimoksha vows, we don't abstain from all 10 non-virtuous actions. Did you know that? We abstain from the 7 actions of body and speech. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, divisive speech, harsh words, and idle gossip. The implication is that to abstain from the mental actions of covetousness, malice, and wrong view are too subtle. They come too quickly to abstain from them. The bodhisattva vows, however, include actions of mind. You abstain from them, negative actions of mind. But the lay person's vows includes just the actions of body and speech. So the Buddha gave the precept of abstaining from killing to prevent the person from creating that heavy negative karma that has all of those effects, negative effects, being born in hell and so forth, but also particularly to cut the tendency, the habitual result of, you know, killing again in the future. Okay? Good question. Thanks, Stephen. Wait, let's see if in someone else. Okay, you had a question? Let him. Next time you can ask. Okay. So quickly. Oh, today's the men's day. Usually the men are shy. Hey, girls, you're getting your cup. You're getting caught up with here.
Not very shy here, but not so abstract. My question is, Venerable, you mentioned just now that Buddha's clairvoyant disciple. I don't know how to say that.
The Tibetans say Mogul Pu.
Okay. Yeah, whatever.
Even that's too long, right?
Yeah, I don't know whether it was in a moment of mischief or whatever he said when asked, where was the Buddha?
Not where was the Buddha.
The disciples asked him.
The non-Buddhist disciples said where their guru was.
Yeah, and he said he did know.
He saw that guru was not a highly realized being. He'd been born in hell. And he told it like it was, you know. Maybe the bodhisattva maybe might have been more careful. You know, say, difficult to say where he is now. He gave you great teachings. You know.
My question is, this person is supposed to be a disciple of Buddha, yes?
Moggallana, yes, he was. Yes.
So what was his motivation or what was going on in his mind when he makes such a speech? Knowing that the consequence of it is, like you mentioned, I do not know whether it's in Buddhist texts that he was beaten to a pup.
Yeah.
And then that created karmic repercussions to those people who beat him, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Then why did he say such a thing, you know?
So you it's know? Difficult to know. Well, difficult to know.
What has it achieved?
It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
If you assume that he had the clairvoyance and knows what's going to happen next, then all of this had to be for a deeper purpose, to teach others that even arhats can experience the result of negative karma while they still have this body and mind to clear away, to leave some kind of doctrinal clarity about that. Like I said, his body was beaten to a pulp, but his mind was at ease, right? There was no You know, he saw the emptiness of this. Many times the Buddha did things, pretended to do things, but with the intention of teaching. You know, things that an enlightened being wouldn't have to do, you know, took a wife and so forth, and then left. I'm not saying that you should do that. So it's difficult to know. I don't know in that particular incident, Mahamoggallana, it's not as though he was ignorant. It's not as though he was being just arrogant. You know, like I said, yeah. But he may have also used the opportunity to help these disciples. Not everyone beat him, not all the disciples. Some of them, if they believed him, because he was a great clairvoyant, they may have then developed some diminishing of respect for their former teacher, who was not teaching a true path, and they may have then been more receptive to receiving the Buddha's teachings, because it was right there. This was the milieu of Buddhism in India. So it's difficult to know. Interesting kind of scenario to try to figure out, but I don't know. I'm not, yeah.
Sorry, don't mean to be personal, but
yeah.
Venerable, have you spoken to Buddha?
Have I spoken to Buddha?
To Buddha, yes. Before you answer, I'll let you know that sometimes in my practice, in the daily practice, I speak to the Buddha image in front of me,
right,
as though it's like a very real personal relationship. Is it wrong?
No, not necessarily. When you say, have I spoken to Buddha?
Not in the wrong
sense. I thought you meant like sometimes the Christians believe they've talked to God, you know. Was it Jerry Falwell or someone? Oh, Jesus told me that America's experiencing all these sufferings because of the homosexuals or something like this. You know, they claim to have spoken to God. I thought that's what you were referring to. I may, as though talking to the omniscient mind, but that's not one of my main. It may happen occasionally. It's said that the bodhisattvas, when they reach a certain level, the path of preparation and accumulation, they reach a certain level that's called the stream of Dharma. Who of you have studied which level is that? The path of preparation or path of accumulation? Preparation. Where they can remember all of the Dharma teachings they ever received. Say, we're talking about bodhisattva on the path of preparation. And they also can receive teachings from the Nirmanakaya aspect of Buddha in statues. Even they can, so if they were to talk to the statue, they'd actually be getting a response. They might be, I remember once at Manjushri Institute, Lama Zopa, we had some kind of ceremony at the end of the teaching year. Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa were there along with others. And someone was passing around statues, and Lama Zopa had this statue of Guru Padmasambhava. It was like he was listening. So when you reach a certain level, you can actually not only talk to the Nirmanakaya aspects. Of course, to talk to the Sambhogakaya aspect, you have to be an Arya Bodhisattva. But to talk, you could talk to the Nirmanakaya aspect. You can actually receive answers, teachings from statues. So when Atisha going around the stupa in Bodh Gaya, hearing the deities debating, what's the quickest way to achieve enlightenment? This is like he had that ability. These were actual emanations of the Nirmanakaya giving advice. So I myself am not on any of those levels. And the Buddha doesn't talk to me in my dreams or in my prayers. But certainly, Lama Yeshe used to say, completely legitimate. You know, sometimes he said, sometimes the Buddhist monks criticize the very faithful lay people. They come up to the statue, and they have some bowl of food, and they put the food in the statue's mouth, you know? And Lama said, great faith, you know, they create great merit this way. Some people might say, the statue's not going to eat the food. Of course, the statue's not going to eat the food, but with this, you know, kind of talking to the statue or talking to, even if it's not a statue, imagining the Buddha there, I think that's completely legitimate and creates a lot of good karma. Okay, can create, as long as you're not criticizing the Buddha. Why didn't you come earlier? You know, I've been asking, you didn't answer. Okay, yeah, where were you when I needed you? So as long as you're not creating some bad speech that way. So let's finish up a couple minutes of dedication. So you're going to remember, right? New batteries. Check the amplifier. Pre-test. And maybe even change the microphone so people have not that embarrassing pause where I could, even with the microphone, I couldn't understand Fari's name. I had every other name. Sorry, Siri. Okay. So sit comfortably. Relax the body. Relax the mind, which is an art in and of itself. And with one portion of your mind, watch the rest of your mind, like your eyes watching here in this classroom, the other people in the class. And sense, even though there are many thoughts perhaps coming, that those thoughts can only be present due to the clarity, the spaciousness of the mind, its non-obstructing nature. And let those thoughts dissipate. Just concentrate on that clear light nature of the mind for a moment. This incredible resource as a human being, this gross consciousness, as Stephen was helping us discriminate between the subtle consciousness and the gross consciousness that has this clear light nature. As a human being right now, we can develop all these good qualities while we're still a human before we die in this gross consciousness, leave imprints that will eventually be imprinted on our subtle consciousness. So think, due to the virtues that I've created today in listening, having motivated with a good motivation, having thought critically, come up with questions, pose them. I've created an incredible store of virtuous karma that will definitely be experienced within cyclic existence. I'm going to make a strong determination that that virtue not ripen simply in some samsaric pleasure that is experienced for a short time, some relief. That's not real nature of happiness. It's actually nature of suffering. But then gone. I'm going to dedicate this merit that in whatever way it ripens, it become a cooperative cause of my continued spiritual development. Day by day, year by year, life by life. Because this karma will not be exhausted immediately in one event. It may have many repercussions in the future. May it become the cause of my following the teachings of Atisha, developing these three principles of the path: renunciation, bodhicitta, the right view of emptiness, the right realization of emptiness. May I, as a result of this karma, may I be inspired to practice the bodhisattva path, reading the Jataka tales, the life stories of the Buddha, how to practice. And if fortunate, may I encounter the teachings of Vajrayana, secret mantra, to quickly achieve enlightenment in a single lifetime of this degenerate age. Due to this karma, may I quickly become totally enlightened, for the sole purpose of benefiting sentient beings, spontaneously and effortlessly as a Buddha, leading them from life to life over whatever time it takes to escape from cyclic existence to achieve their own enlightenment. Taking cognizance of all the living beings throughout space that have been our mother numberless times in the past. We have this intimate relationship with all beings. And we're also, in a sense, not limited to this particular body. We can identify with them because we're equal with them in wanting to be free of suffering and wanting to be happy. We're equal with them in having the Buddha nature, emptiness of the mind. So naturally, wanting to eliminate that suffering, just as we like to eliminate our own suffering. Due to these merits, may I quickly become a Buddha for the sake of all sentient beings. Thanks for your attention. See you either next week, or there's another series of talks I'll be giving starting on Tuesday night and Thursday nights. First on what's called Lojong, Lorig, Lojong, the awareness and knowing, talking about the psychology, the Buddhist understanding of the mental factors, and also talking about the ways that we know phenomena, epistemology epistemological side of awareness and knowing. So that's going to be beginning on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You're welcome to come to that. If not, hope to see you again next weekend. Keep cool, keep chilled, not just physically cool, but like the arhat, you know, chill. And if your mind in the midst of chaos, if you could remember, you know, my mind is, you know, all these things are happening, but my mind is at ease, that'd be great. Thank you so much. I did better today coughing, right? I didn't cough so many times. I think the medications and everything have kicked in. Thank you very much. What is your name?
Sin.
Oh, that's right. You're Cindy. Thank you, Sin. Thank you very much. Aww. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.